This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What if they gave a vaccine and nobody came? Well, that's just about what is happening in the efforts by the Bush administration to vaccinate hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers against smallpox, part of the war on terrorism. Last December, the president proposed a plan by which 500,000 healthcare workers would volunteer to be vaccinated by this time this year. But so far, just a fraction of them, about 38,000, have rolled up their sleeves. Some fear the rare side effects of the vaccine. Some worry about spreading it to other people who may not want to be vaccinated. Some worry about having to take sick time off from their work, and they're not covered. Now, phase two of the plan calls for another 10 million people to be vaccinated, and these would be the first responders, your firefighters, police, emergency room, hospital personnel, followed then by the general public. But last week, a panel of experts that advises the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommended that phase two, this mass vaccination, be put on hold, that the current level of vaccination of healthcare workers should continue, but the effort to vaccinate the next 10 million people should not. The panel cited a, quote, new and unanticipated safety concern, unquote. A small number of vaccinated people, 22 out of approximately 38,000, were experiencing inflammation of the heart muscle and its lining. And this week, a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association surveyed 500,000 military personnel who had received the vaccine and found that it did cause a small number of heart problems. But still, the study concluded that, quote, mass smallpox vaccinations can be conducted safely with very low rates of serious adverse events, unquote. This hour, we'll be talking about the vaccination program, where it might lead, where it is headed. And just before we begin, a side note, Dr. Julie Gerberding, head of the CDC, was scheduled to be a guest today, but her appearance was canceled. Now, I tell you this not because we never have guests canceling. We have guests canceling all the time. But what makes this unusual is the way that Dr. Gerberding's appearance was initially arranged. Not through the usual channels of going through her civilian press office, but it came through the Department of Defense, the Pentagon. It was the DOD, unusually, that arranged for her appearance. And I have to say, maybe I'm a little behind the times. I've only been doing this 30 years or so. And I've been talking to public health officials, be they from the FDA, the NIH, the CDC. And never in my 30 years, in my experience, has the Pentagon arranged and controlled contact of a high-placed civilian official not attached to the Defense Department. Maybe this is a new world order we're living in. That said, if you have questions about smallpox or vaccine, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me now introduce my guests. Joseph Henderson is the Associate Director for Terrorism Preparedness and Emergency Response at the CDC. He joins us today from our studios in Washington. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Henderson.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. William Winkenwerder is Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs for the Department of Defense. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Winkenwerder.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Brian Strom is the Chairman of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Smallpox Vaccination Program Implementation. Now, of course, you know the Institute of Medicine is part of National Academies of Science. Dr. Strom is also the George S. Pepper Professor of Public Health and Preventive Medicine. This goes on a while here. Professor of Medicine and Pharmacology, Director of the Center for Clinical Epidemiology and Biostatistics at University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He joins us by phone from Philadelphia. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Strom.
My pleasure.
We've run out of time. No. Dr. Gregory Poland is a new committee member of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. He's also a professor of medicine, molecular pharmacology, and experimental therapeutics, and director of the Vaccine Research Group at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Poland is also the American Regional Editor of the journal Vaccine. He joins us by phone from Rochester, Minnesota. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Poland.
My pleasure.
Let me begin with you. Joseph Henderson, has the administration rethought maybe its ideas about implementing the vaccination in phase two?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services are very committed to ensuring a high degree of smallpox readiness, and a vaccine is a part of that process. I, my personal opinion and the opinion of the CDC at this point is that we've made a significant amount of progress over the past year in increasing smallpox preparedness. We obviously need to sit down and have some discussions about the future of the program. We're very committed to working with our state and local colleagues to decide where we go. But we're in a better place today than we were last year, and we have some ways to go, obviously.
Your quote in the Washington Post is saying it is not a practical approach right now. Is that an accurate quote?
Not a practical approach, and I'm trying to understand the context of that particular.
It says this whole sentence story. Says investing almost solely in vaccinations is, quote, is not a
Absolutely.
Practical approach right now.
Yeah, that's fair to say, and I would still support that. I think that in looking at smallpox readiness, the individuals who are vaccinated, who we would call upon to investigate cases, to treat those cases that may appear in emergency departments, is part of our overall smallpox readiness. But we need to have systems that have plans in place that they can exercise and execute those plans if we were to see smallpox cases, where they can contain those cases, interrupt the spread of the disease, et cetera. So there's more to smallpox preparedness than just a vaccination program.
Greg Poland, last week your committee recommended that the second phase of the president's plan not be implemented. Would you tell us why?
It might be a bit strong to say not implemented. I think what the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices was trying to get across is two things. Number one, continue on with the military program, although the ACIP doesn't have any direct control over that. Number two, in the civilian program, continue on at the level that the individual states thought was necessary to ensure public health readiness, but pause, not stop, but pause before expanding it greatly into a wide circle of healthcare workers and first responders until we had a better handle on these myopericarditis cases.
So you would amend with the president, but not eliminate it totally. You leave it up to the states to decide on their own?
Correct.
If they wanted to continue, they should continue.
Now what? Through phase one.
Through phase one. And far as phase two, you say we should pause and study what?
Well, as you know, and that's probably what prompted today's call, is that there have been cases of this myopericarditis, which is just inflammation of the heart or the outside lining of the heart. These cases are all relatively new and fresh. They've all been notified and investigated just in the last couple of months. So we need to understand the full extent of it. We need to understand whether there'll be any long-term sequelae from it.
Has the CDC, whom you advise, has the CDC agreed with your recommendations, and will they be implementing them?
When you say my recommendation,
well, your committee's recommendation.
Yes. Now, that was just last week that the ACIP made that recommendation. So how that will then go to CDC, how they'll handle that is unclear to me at this point.
Has the CDC ever not listened to its advisory committee on things like this?
I really don't have an answer for that. I'm not sure. I'm a new member of that committee,
okay.
So can't answer
well,
that.
Well, ask someone from the CDC who might know this. Joe Henderson?
Yeah, CDC extremely values the scientific opinions and the recommendations that we receive from our advisory committees. And even in the past, if there's been recommendations where we have not fully embraced the recommendations, we always consider those recommendations as we decide on the future of a particular program and how we make our policy decisions.
So how much of this will you embrace?
Well, we have there's a number of recommendations that we're currently looking at. As you know, the Institute of Medicine is also making recommendations for the director of CDC to consider. And I think it's important and prudent for us at this time to look at those recommendations and decide how that will impact our future policy regarding smallpox. And keep in mind, it's not just CDC's responsibility here. There's a responsibility of the Department of Health and Human Services and also the White House and the administration to consider. And we're taking all these factors into consideration right now.
Dr. Strom, when you were with us on Science Friday back in April, you told us you were especially concerned about the cases of myopericarditis because they were showing up in people who had never been exposed to the vaccine. And the military study conducted also shows those side effects, doesn't it?
Correct.
Tell us why that would happen. To explain what the effect was and what it might mean.
Well, it suggests, this is far from definite yet, and certainly as Dr. Poland described, there needs to be much more work to evaluate them in more detail. But the fact that the cases are showing up primarily in people who were not vaccinated before suggests that they may actually be virally induced, that it may be the virus of the smallpox vaccine is a live virus. It's not smallpox, but it's a related virus. And viruses can cause infections of the heart. And it suggests that that may be what's happening here, where people who've had the vaccine before have some element of immunity and so aren't getting that same infection of the heart.
Mm-hmm. This is Greg Pullen. I might make one comment about that, and it's relatively new information. The military cases that we're seeing are in primary vaccinees, but somewhat surprisingly, or at least interesting, is that many of the cases that are occurring on the civilian side are in revaccinees. The other interesting, and it's just one piece of data, but there has been a case where there was an actual heart muscle biopsy. And quite surprising is that the cell type that you would expect to see there were this a viral induced illness was not there. Rather, and this will mean something to the physicians on the line, a different cell line called the eosinophil was present. That's a cell type generally seen in correlated with a almost sort of allergic or inflammatory type response. Highly significant because the treatment for that is steroids, which you might be afraid to give if you thought that the vaccinia virus was actually present in the heart. The other significant point about that is it may have nothing to do with the vaccine virus, but rather some other component that the body has an allergic reaction to. And in the unique case of this vaccine, it is a vaccine produced in cows, the current one that's licensed in the U.S., and it would not be preposterous, though it is speculative at this point on my part, that perhaps this is a reaction to a bovine protein or to some other component of the vaccine.
So it's an allergic reaction that may be triggered to something else that needs a combination of factors?
That's a hypothesis, yeah. Given that we did not see under the microscope what you would have expected to see if it were direct viral invasion of the heart muscle.
Very interesting.
It's very fascinating. I mean, and all of this, which is obviously very new information, as Dr. Pullen said, is part of why it's so important. Our committee also has called for a pause. The
Institute of Medicine.
Correct.
Yeah.
And it's part of why we think the pause is so important.
Now, there's another point, if I might make here, that I think we're sort of missing. I think healthcare workers on the civilian side, the uptake of the vaccine was lower than anticipated, as you were pointing out, primarily because of two reasons. Number one, concerns of safety, and those concerns had nothing to do with myopericarditis. I don't think the average healthcare worker ever associated this vaccine with this complication. Rather, they were concerned about the high rate of complications that were serious but were historically known. And virtually none of those happened in this program. And the second, and whether this was the first or second problem that influenced their thinking is hard to know, but difficulties with getting past the appropriate workman's compensation type program so that if a healthcare worker was injured, there was some mechanism by which their livelihood and their salaries could be protected. So the interesting point to me is that in the civilian side, we have about 37,000 people and far higher numbers on the Department of Defense side. This program actually turned out to be very safe. Essentially, none of the serious complications, I mean, there's onesies and twosies cases, didn't occur. Rather, what occurred, though at a low level, and let me stress, at a low level, higher than what, is the background rate, what occurred was this sort of unanticipated side effect of myopericarditis. So I wouldn't want listeners to get the idea that, that this was much more dangerous than anybody thought.
All right, I've got to take a break. Yeah. We'll come back. Hang on, gentlemen. We'll be right back after this short break. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the smallpox vaccination program with my guest, Joseph Henderson, Associate Director for Terrorism Preparedness and Response at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, William Winkenwerter, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs at the DOD, Brian Strom, Chairman of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Smallpox Vaccination Program Implementation, Gregory Poland, member of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Our number, 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Dr. Winkenwetter, let's talk about the study this week that you conducted and was in the Journal of the American Medical Association about this. You found a very low level of problems in the soldiers, correct?
Ira, that's correct. Thank you for finally getting to what I think is the main message here, and that is that through a very well-conducted and extensively carried out study, we were able to, I think, fairly and scientifically come to the conclusion that the smallpox vaccine can be administered safely and effectively to a large number of people. We vaccinated over 450,000 service members in a spectrum of ages, sexes, and races, and this was done on four continents and hundreds or dozens of ships at sea. And what we learned from that is that the adverse event rates that that were all we had to go from historically of 35 to 40 years ago, that the adverse event rates did not occur at the rates that had been expected. For example, severe skin reactions that had in the past occurred at a rate of up to 40 cases per million vaccinees, we had zero of those cases. When it came to encephalitis, which was something that people had worried a great deal about, occurring up to, in the past, thought to be 7 cases per million, we had one suspected case. It was not confirmed, but to the benefit of the doubt, we listed it. The matter of transfer of inoculating oneself with the virus, with a vaccine virus, right there was about a tenth of what had been known historically. And I would add to that, probably one of the most significant findings was that among 27,000 healthcare workers, who were vaccinated, not a single case was transferred, there was not a single case of transfer of the vaccine virus to a patient. Mm. This had been a big concern. So I think the message ought to be that a lot of concerns that people had ought to be laid to rest.
But this is in the military population, correct?
That's right.
But isn't the military have a lot of young, healthy people who have free medical care and access to the best kind of medical attention and get physicals all the time? So how much would you expect to slough over this kind of effect, you know, or these results into an aging population of Americans?
Well, the population of people that the civilian sector is seeking to vaccinated is not an aging or ill population. They're healthy healthcare workers, and for the most part, young nurses or physicians or medics, in the first responder community. In fact, it almost exactly mirrors the military population. I would add to that we vaccinated over 50,000 people over the age of 40, and our experience, of course, includes that group of people. Nothing that we did is something that couldn't be done by a good community hospital or a good local public health department. We believe that our good experience was due to a few things. One, that there was very careful attention to training of the medical staff, extensive education and screening. We screened out about 10-15% of those that might have been vaccinated, and they never did get vaccinated because of a skin condition, or they were pregnant, or there were other had HIV or immune system problems, and then close monitoring and follow-up, and then intervention if there was an adverse event. Mm-hmm. So let me say that I think that our experience can be duplicated, and generally when in the medical literature a good experience is identified and described, it's the kind of thing that everyone seeks to emulate and model.
Very interesting.
So we hope that that's what we can do.
Greg Poland, I know you have to go, but I want to get a comment from you about if in the civilian population, if civilians get the shots or a civilian has a heart attack a month later, how do we know it isn't is or isn't related to the vaccination. Do we need to monitor the civilians more closely?
Yes, well, of course, something that happens months later is very difficult to know, and you may never know that. You did mention heart attacks, and there have been reports of heart attacks after receiving the vaccine. I think it is worth pointing out, though, that in those cases where it's been investigated, those individuals had very significant pre-existing heart disease, and the rate at which heart attacks in particular have occurred has not exceeded the rate in people who have not gotten the vaccine. So it's not clear that heart attacks per se are something that are caused by or triggered by the vaccine. I think we're a little closer to the mark when we talk about myopericarditis.
Dr. Bluma, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Let me just weigh in there to say that our experience showed that we did have some individuals, about 16 out of that 450-plus thousand, who had some type of ischemic event, is what the clinical term would be, in the 30-day period afterward. But if one took a similar population of people as we did and compared, one would have expected actually 25 such mm-hmm. cases
exactly.
that
yeah.
would normally have occurred. And so one might even infer that the vaccine could be protective. Mm-hmm. So I think it's way too early to conclude that there's a risk here. Right. If anything, it's just something that we need to be mindful of.
Dr. Poland, I know you have to go, so let me say goodbye to you. Thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Gregory Poland is a new committee member of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Before we get the hour gets away from us, let's see if we can take a phone call or two on the line. Jill in Los Angeles. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I'm Jill Ferrello, and I direct the National Affairs for the California Nurses Association. California Nurses Association is the largest state nurses association in the country. When the smallpox program was first announced, our organization decided that we would oppose the smallpox program because we felt that there were some dangers associated with the virus or the vaccine, and that we were concerned that emergency room nurses and other frontline workers were going to be needlessly exposed because we didn't really see what the need was for this actual program. What we have found is that with the implementation of the smallpox program, that other public health, essential public health programs have been downsized as a result of the diversion of funds to the smallpox program. So we would, given the new study and the results of the study, I think that we would not only support the fact that phase two should be put on hold, but we would also urge that phase one be stopped immediately based upon this information. In terms of the public health programs that have been affected by the smallpox program, we have seen that there's been an increase in tuberculosis cases reported, for example, in Seattle, because the TB program has been downsized and cut back. Arizona has, Pima County, Arizona, where in the southern part of the state has reported a 200% increase in new syphilis cases because that program has been cut back. An average of 36,000 deaths per year from influenza occurs in our country. We believe that the public health needs are not being met as a result of a program that is clear that frontline emergency workers don't really want to participate in. We know that there was widespread resistance throughout the country to participation in this program. Specifically, we know that there were over 350 hospitals and nurses organizations in Texas, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, California, Wisconsin, New Jersey that completely opted out of the program.
All right, Jill, I got to get an answer in here because we're running out of time. I think we got the gist of your question. Any reaction from my panelists?
Yeah, this is Joe Henderson from the CDC. I'll just take a quick stab at a response. Jill, thanks for the question. We understand the concerns, and these are concerns that we've been managing since the president made the policy decision in December. This is a bad time, I think, for public health in general and for a lot of municipalities dealing with shrinking state and local budgets. There's not been a cut, though, in the public health programs that are focused on terrorism preparedness and response, and that's one of the reasons why we attach the smallpox preparedness activities very explicitly to the guidance that we issued to the states on the 1st of May. So in the $1 billion that's being distributed to the state and local health agencies to enhance preparedness to include smallpox, We feel that there is plenty of resources to be able to support terrorism preparedness and response, but not at the cost of other public health programs, and that is a concern for us. We don't want to see other public health programs suffer in any way, shape, or form.
So that's $1 billion distributed to all the hospitals around the country?
Well, it goes to state and a number of large local public health agencies.
Doesn't sound like a heck of a lot of money.
Well, it's really not. I think we're going to clearly need additional funds to support an infrastructure that can not only respond to terrorism events but also deal with other public health emergencies. But it's a lot more than we had prior to September 11th. That prior to September 11th, our external grant program was a $50 million activity.
I'm sorry.
Ira, let me just to add a point and with regard to the concern about the threat, and that it is that it's understandable that people who would not have intelligence information or the kind of information that we have to in our jobs be made aware of and have as important factors in the way that we consider tough issues, that's not widespread public information, and it can't be. But I can assure the caller that all of us here and all of us that advise the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of Health and Human Services, and the President sought to balance the risks and the benefits. And the threat of smallpox is there. It's very difficult to put a figure or a number on it. What we know is that the former Soviet Union had weaponized a large quantity of smallpox. We don't know where all of that is today. We do know that terrorists have identified bioweapons as a weapon of preferred use, and heaven forbid that anyone would ever get their hands on it. But it only stands to reason that our country takes steps to be prepared, and surely there can be a debate about how that preparation should unfold and how much of the preparation needs to be vaccination versus or to include vaccination along with other approaches. But from my perspective, I would just say it makes sense for us to have a significant cadre of healthcare workers and medical people who could take care of things in the event of an attack. As it stands now, the military would be called upon to do much of that.
What you hear people in the hospitals who are making up the cadre is that they're being, instead of being new people being hired to do this, other people are being pulled off their normal jobs to take care of this. I heard of a situation of a San Francisco State San Francisco General Hospital, a gentleman who was in charge of pediatric vaccinations normally for the kids, he was taken off of this and now put on to
An issue. That's a local trade-off issue, and certainly implementing a program like this, being prepared for bioterror, is something that takes new dollars and new efforts, or it's going to take away from other things. And I think most of us think that those other things do need to continue to be done.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about being prepared for bioterrorism this hour. Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So where is the new dollars coming from? You said $1 billion doesn't, as I say, doesn't sound like a lot of money. Or are we just giving this lip service now, saying it should be done, but I'm going to pass the buck to somebody else who should be putting the money in?
Ira, this is Joe again, Henderson. Mm-hmm. And clearly, we are not giving this lip service. We take this very seriously, as we take public health preparedness for all potential threats very seriously. And I have to say that, just to build on Dr. Winkenwerter's comments, you know, SARS has shown us how unpredictable that outbreaks of infectious diseases can be and how they can severely impact not only our healthcare system, but I think our global health system and our global economic systems. And we're looking to make a significant investment here. We're looking for continued appropriations to come from Congress to support this. And we're hopeful that state and local health agencies will see this as a priority so that we can improve national readiness to respond to these events. So should we see a case of smallpox or some other type of threat that's brought upon our populations by terrorist groups, we can contain them as rapidly as possible and minimize death. Mm-hmm.
Brian Strom, the Institute of Medicine's March report says that communities should measure their preparedness to respond to a smallpox outbreak by how effectively their public health and medical personnel and other responders are coordinated, not solely by the number of workers who've been vaccinated. We're sitting here talking about numbers.
And we feel very strongly, and I know CDC agrees with this, that it is a mistake to be talking about numbers. I think you began the program talking about the 500,000 and the 10 million, and that isn't what we should be talking about. We should be talking about preparedness, what's required for preparedness. There is a lot that has to be done to be prepared in terms of having the public health system and the health departments and our clinical health system prepared to be able to handle cases if the cases arrive. If that's the case, it might not even need vaccination, or if it needs vaccination, the numbers of people who need to be vaccinated should be dictated by what is required for preparedness. That's exactly what's called for in the new CDC guidance that Joe Henderson was talking about with the $1 billion, is to focus on preparedness and to focus on the vaccination in the context of preparedness, and we strongly agree with that.
And could I just make a point in here, Ira? And I want to just loop back to your initial comment about the unusual nature of the Pentagon exchanging or pulling in the CDC to a discussion like this. I would just have you know, and all the listeners know, that we work hand in glove with the CDC. We are part of the public health preparedness of this country. And long before the CDC and others in the civilian sector were concerned about bioweapons and biodefense, it was a concern of the Department of Defense. I view DOD as having a significant responsibility to do the kind of work that we've done, where we're able to do, as we did with the smallpox vaccine, and implement that program, to quickly share this information with the civilian sector, and then to work closely and collaborate with the CDC and with the NIH and with others. And I think we're at the dawn of a new era where we really, frankly, have to all work and pull together.
All right,
but I should say for the record that DOD does not maintain Dr. Gerberding's schedule.
No.
Could have fooled
me. We talk frequently.
It's a troubling trend, let me tell you.
Don't be troubled. We talk frequently on the phone, and she keeps me apprised, and I keep her apprised.
It didn't sound that way this week. We've run out of time. You got the last word on that. Let me thank my guest, Joseph Henderson, the Associate Director of Terrorism Preparedness and Emergency Response at the CDC, William Winkenwerter, who is Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs for the Department of Defense, and Brian Strom, Chairman of the Institute of Medicine's Committee on Smallpox Vaccination Program Implementation. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the confusing stories of hormone replacement therapy, so stay with us. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.